You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiegert. One bombshell after another on the U.S.-Russia front. Friday saw the Mueller investigation roll out grand jury indictments against 12 Russian nationals for allegedly hacking during the 2016 presidential campaign in efforts to influence the outcome. Monday's summit between President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin saw Putin strenuously deny the charges, or at least any involvement by the Russian state, and Donald Trump jump on board with the denial, calling the Mueller probe, quote, disastrous.
I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today. And what he did is an incredible offer. He offered to have the people working on the case come and work with their investigators with respect to the 12 people. I think that's an incredible offer.
Then, shortly after the press conference on Monday, the FBI arrested one Butina Maria, also a Russian national, for allegedly violating the Foreign Agent Registration Act. This is, according to the DOJ's narrative, part of a conspiracy to build influence within an unnamed gun rights organization, almost certainly the National Rifle Association. I thought this would be a good time to break down the significance of the charges from a Russian eye view. We're joined in studio by Elizaveta Osetinskaya, former editor of the RBC news site in Russia. She led the Russian side of the Panama Papers investigation. Shortly after that was published, her entire team got fired. She's now a fellow at UC Berkeley's Investigative Reporting Project and the founder of a new Russian language publication called The Bell. Lisa, thank you for coming in.
Hello.
Let's start with what we know as of Friday. What do we know about the 12 Russians that are named in the indictment?
Well, we all together, I would say all Russians and all Americans, know almost nothing. I'm pretty much surprised that names of those people appeared anywhere. I also wonder how Mueller was able to get those names, because I think that this is a very deep secret.
Deep secret, why?
Because all those people normally work under secret circumstances. In Russia, that's very hard to find, let's say, 0.0001% of population who even know what's the name and the last name of head of this service.
This is the GRU.
GRU, yeah. So what can we say about people who work there? That's unbelievable. It couldn't be just information taken from digital side or servers. It should be a certain leakage or whistleblower.
So you and the Bell set out to corroborate whatever you could through publicly available sources of information about these people and about the address they worked from. What were you able to find?
So the only thing, basically, we were able to find that those people allegedly connected to crypto department of GRU.
Decryption.
Decryption, yeah. So let me explain how it looks like. For example, near neighborhood where I used to live in Moscow, there is a so-called Vernadsky Avenue. There are three very high buildings with no signs what is inside. One was under construction through all my life. Two of them were working, and no one knew what's going on there. So that was like a black box. Presumably, some of those people could work in these buildings.
Got it. A building that is a black box.
Black box, yeah.
Yeah. Can you explain a little bit what the GRU is and how far removed it is from the control and oversight of Vladimir Putin?
GRU is a intel part of Ministry of Defense.
So it's strictly
military. So this
military.
Is strictly military organization. And all military-related organizations, their chiefs are hired and fired directly by the president. So they're technically a part of the government, but prime minister cannot appoint them. So they're appointed by Putin. So, yeah, they're definitely under Kremlin's control.
When Vladimir Putin, at the press conference after the Trump-Putin summit, addressed these allegations of hacking, he was specific to say the Russian state was not involved in the hacking.
The Russian state has never interfered and is not going to interfere into internal American affairs, including election process.
To me, that meant he was leaving the wiggle room to say that if these individuals are found guilty of hacking, they were doing it on their own, or they were rogue elements, or they were somehow not doing so as representatives of the Russian government. Did you hear the same thing in his comments?
Well, we have been observed the same tactics again and again, starting from 2014 in Ukraine. Russian officials say there were no Russian formal military spies, whoever. I think they could apply the same tactic here. For example, who is a troll king, Prigozhin? From the point of view of Russian government, they say they're just a patriotically thinking man, but this is a private party.
You're referring to the Internet Research Agency, the quote-unquote troll farm, where 12 other Russians were indicted for alleged influence during the 2016 operation. But that, on paper, is a privately owned organization, on paper, that is separate from the Russian government. The GRU is within the military chain of command.
Yeah, I can only make certain assumptions here. For example, we know already that one of those 12 resigned or was fired in 2018. Presumably he left. So he is a private party. So I think this is the same tactic will be applied here in this case too. That could be very useful in as PR strategy, saying like, oh my God, those people even, they never worked for GRU, for example, or this is such a deep state secret, how would you know? Or these people didn't exist, or something like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, how do you think Robert Mueller could know about the identities of these people?
This is a very good question. We only can make some guesses here, but as Bell reported in our December investigation, there were some people having relationships with FSB, either worked for FSB or connected to FSB.
FSB is like the Russian...
Like FBI.
Okay.
So those people were accused in prison.
Okay.
And as our sources said, they might leak information to US side about hacking. We don't know for sure what kind of information, but we know that to discover how hacking was organized and who was in charge of hacking, to get information from server, that was not enough just to get information from server, because server contains IP addresses or phishing emails, but there are no names of people, certainly, or none of them say, like, this is a Colonel Ivanov or, you know, Deputy Colonel Petrov. Mm-hmm. Or general, you know, in chief of something. So someone should have leaked this information to U.S. intel community or to Mueller investigative group. And this is a very good question, how they got this information.
Yeah. So your reporting is pointed to a former FSB member named Sergei Mikhailov.
Mikhailov, yeah.
Who's now facing charges of treason. How public is the content of those charges?
It's not public.
So you know he's being detained, you know he's facing trial, but you don't know what the indictment reads?
No, because this is all state secret.
So how certain are you that the charges are related to this person releasing information to the United States?
Well, we talked to certain sources, so we cannot reveal our sources. But so we had sources that helped us to...
More than one.
More than one. To basically two sources. Also, it was interesting that it was also mentioned in New York Times publication that came out maybe March of 2017, that in opinion piece was something also confirming this hypothesis, even before we came out with our investigation.
So let me back up a second. There's now two rounds of indictments against Russian nationals in the Mueller probe.
the first round, which we asked you on to talk about, was part of an alleged influence operation run out of the Internet Research Agency, what's often described as a troll farm, a nominally private entity within Russia run by a close associate of Putin and an oligarch. Now there's this separate set of indictments at people who allegedly work for the GRU, for military intelligence. How likely is it, do you think, that these two very different organizations were coordinating?
We don't have much information there. I think both are equally possible, because I think both sides could have goal to prove the importance.
To prove the importance for the
Kremlin. I'm not sure that coordination between two of those branches was so necessary. Although we know that Prigozhin had important contracts, commercial contracts with Ministry of Defense, and we also know that he, a few months ago, lost this contract. So they had certain affiliation with militaries. But this is still not enough to say that they were orchestrated by someone and they acted together. Right. Or they were just competing to prove how important they are and how efficient they are.
So suffice it to say, if there was a widespread understanding that you needed to influence the U.S. election to keep yourself in the good graces of Vladimir Putin, they both could have done what they're alleged to have done without any coordination between them.
Because there could be certain incentives without coordination. Mm-hmm. What are the incentives? Let's say you shouldn't be a scientist or, you know, deep throat to understand that Vladimir Putin wouldn't like Hillary Clinton to be a president because he publicly blamed her for involvement into 2011 Russian elections. So she was not a comfortable candidate for him. That's obvious. If you're enough close to Putin to realize his current mood and direction of his thoughts, if you're smart enough, as Prigozhin, for example, you can understand that certain actions could bring you certain benefits.
So it's not necessarily a command and control structure with Putin at the top, more about a set of expectations that exist within the government, within the state.
Could be. I mean, could be. Mm-hmm.
How are these indictments being covered in Russia, in the Russian language press?
It's covered in the news. I would say the coverage is quite dry, unemotional. Very few people are able to, and or have time, or have requests from their editors to go deeper.
Well, how much of a problem do you think it is for Vladimir Putin to be attached to interference in the U.S. election in 2016?
Do you mean to acknowledge that, yes, Russia did this?
Well, clearly he's not going to acknowledge it. But even to have the information circulating publicly with the weight of a federal indictment behind it, that his government was probably involved, does it make him look stronger or does it hurt his standing?
I think in terms of PR for Russian public and also internationally, he looks strong because he was able to interfere the strongest electoral system on the planet and the strongest democracy. So people judge how strong you are, you know, compared to your enemies. So I think this is a elevator for him, you know, to be on such a high level. And politically, I think he's getting bigger because of constant repeating of this story. So even let's imagine for a second that everything he is saying is true. So America and Europe gave him credits for hacking and interfering the most effective electoral system on the planet. Such a great guy, the most powerful man on the planet. Mm. Wow.
And the founder of a new publication about Russia and business in Russia called The Bell. It has editions in both Russian and English. That takes us to 7:23 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards Tiekert.
And I'm Antonia Yuhas.
Wow.
Wow, right?
So it wasn't until we were off the air that I got to watch the entire press conference that happened while we were on the air. We cut away from the questions because I thought they'll be kind of predictable. Donald Trump will say stuff that he can't be held to anyway.
You know, we had a great analysis with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies looking at the key policy issues, which was really important to do. But then fortunately in the questions, we had these two great reporters from the AP and the Reuters who put pretty fundamental questions to both presidents, and President Trump answered them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So President Trump told us, which we're going to go into even more in the next half hour, some pretty amazing stuff about that we really needed to trust the Russians more than the Americans in terms of investigating the 2016 election tampering, and perhaps allow Russian agents to come to the United States and conduct an investigation that would be superior to that of the FBI. And we'll get into that more. And there's been a lot of coverage on that. But before we do that, can we take a second to talk about what was at the top of the question and answer period that we missed?
What was at the top of the question and answer period that we missed?
Well, this got missed by a lot of folks for good reason, but also for bad reason. So the bad reason is that what was at the top of the question and answer period was an entire question and many minutes spent on oil and gas, and how the U.S. and Russia are oil and gas superpowers, as both presidents made sure to explain. Because the very first question at the press conference that was taken was from a Russian reporter, and it was about the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline.
This is the gas pipeline whose prospective construction led Donald Trump to accuse Germany of being a captive of Russia.
Not once, but twice. First at the NATO press conference, then at the press conference with Theresa May, and now again at the press conference with Vladimir Putin. And this is a natural gas pipeline that would carry natural gas from Russia under the Baltic to Germany. And Trump brought it up twice to say that by being so dependent on Russian natural gas, the Germans are going to be captive of the Russians, and the U.S. sells natural gas and LNG too, and you should let us build it too. And he took a very strong stance at both of those press conferences. At this press conference with Putin by his side, as was the theme throughout the entire press conference, he took a much lighter stance and said, you know, Russia and I and the U.S. are competitors. We're both going to be producing a lot of oil and natural gas in the future. The Russians are closer. They have a locational advantage, he said, so that makes sense. But then he made sure to reaffirm first that the United States is the largest producer of oil and natural gas. I believe he probably said the biggest. I'm not going to get his exact words because I don't speak in quite in Trumpology. But in any case, we are the biggest and the best oil producer. And unlike years past where we weren't taking advantage of all of our oil and gas production, Trump said now we are. And he said we're going to keep producing a lot. Then Putin picked up the ball on that note, reasserted that both Russia and the United States are global oil and gas leaders, and that the countries would work together to make sure that the price of oil stays high, and that he assured Americans that this would be really great for our shale development, and that the two countries would work together to keep the price high so that production continued, but not so high that we don't produce enough.
You're the oil expert.
Yes.
Isn't that the exact opposite of the oil-based geopolitics of the Obama years, which was to ramp up oil production domestically, share fracking technology in other countries, and try to force so much oil into the market that you weakened countries like Venezuela and Russia?
I don't buy that was necessarily the intentional strategy of the Obama administration at all. I think what was happening was that the production coming out of the Bakken region of North Dakota was almost entirely unregulated in its production coming out of the Bush years when it was begun. Production surged. Production surged all over the world because as the price had fallen for oil, you need to produce more of it to get even close to the same amount of money coming into your coffer. So if you're
particularly
Russia,
pressing,
if you're a petro state,
and the oil is your budget,
that's right. So you're going to produce more and more and more and more, so that you can get at least a similar amount of income. And of course, it wasn't. It was significantly less coming into your budget. I don't believe that there was a strategy orchestrated by President Obama to attack petrostates by flooding the market with oil. He didn't control oil in the Bakken. And what happened was, as the price of oil fell, there was a sort of what you would think would be illogical, which was ramping up of production all over the world in response to the ramp up of production in the Bakken.
Well, which is the circumstance that OPEC was essentially created to avert.
Well, originally OPEC actually was created to avert dominance of the oil market by the Seven Sisters oil companies. Mm-hmm. It was a way to retake control of the market from seven Western oil companies that controlled the market.
Got it. Okay. So not exactly a 180-degree turn, but a departure from the geopolitics of oil in recent years.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, so what was really astounding, and if anyone read my tweets going into the press conference, which apparently Putin and Trump did, or listened to our interview with Ralph Momondov yesterday talking about oil politics, what was fairly astounding was Russia and the United States as two global oil superpowers standing up next to each other and saying, we're going to cooperate on this issue, on making sure that oil stays at a price where we can all make money off of it and we continue to use it. Because the second part of that was that Putin said, we don't want to price it so high that people move away from it, right? So that was, he didn't say move away from it, but he said, we're not going to overprice it so that it can't be, so that it can't be affordable is what he said. And so we're going to stay in that sweet spot. And the United States and Russia are going to coordinate to make sure that the global price of oil stays in that sweet spot where we all make lots of money off of it, but we keep producing it and using it well into the future.
Mm-hmm.